Good evening and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 612, and it's nice to be back after a bit of a break from the last round at Knock Hill. We'll be talking BSB, but before we get into the meat of the racing that was from Snetterton this weekend, I do want to just throw a quick shout out to one of our regular donors, Joshua Tootle, who was kind enough to donate in the last week. Joshua, thank you kindly. It's much appreciated, as to all those who help and support us financially, including with reviews and comments, feedback. All helps. Thank you very much indeed. Now, it's a BSB show, so joining me on the line from the UK is our Paddock Chatter regular, Mr. Dave Neal. Hi, Dave.
Andy, good evening. How are you?
Very, very well. We were talking earlier about, you know, our little sort of strategies for managing the summer heat. I think we've got pretty much the same temperatures. We've got about 38 degrees here and a little bit sticky.
Yeah, we're 32 degrees. I'm sat here wearing nothing but a flannel over my man parts. talking to the learned listeners of Motopod, so it would be rude to flap about at the same time. So
I didn't even know that they justified an entire flannel.
It's a damp flannel. It has to be, because I have to call my nether regions. I have my nets closed in the flat so people can't see me. I have a towel draped across my chair where I am currently speaking to you from, with a small damp flannel.
And that is a picture that listeners on their commutes and as they listen to the show can just visualize. You're welcome. There is no charge.
No, I have t-shirt and shorts on. Sorry to burst the bubble, but I do actually have t-shirts.
I think there's only one listener. I can think of one listener right now who is smiling at that image.
Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Jen.
There's been some good racing on. There's been some good bit of action. We've had a bit of a holiday, haven't we? You've been up mountains. I've been up small hills in Lancashire. And yep. I've been to the Speedway as well. Remember me telling you about that on the last show?
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that. And I was super excited because that's something I used to do as a kid. Not something I've done for a number of years. And it sounds like you've had a really good time.
It was fantastic. As I said on the last show, I'd dipped in and out of Speedway for years and years. The only disappointing thing for the evening for Jen and I was the fact that it rained. So the guys whoever was third and fourth in the race, they just couldn't see a thing. They were coated almost from the end of lap one. Yeah. So that was slightly disappointing. But the front two guys, the captain at Bellevue, Max Frick, and the captain of Ipswich Witches was Chris Bomber-Harris. So two really good names to watch, and it was fabulous. You know, thankfully only the one crash and no injuries, but what a fantastic stadium Bellevue is in Manchester. Absolutely incredible, the National Speedway Stadium. Jennifer's hooked on it already. She had an absolute ball, and the guys that we were stood around, we didn't go into the stand up alongside the start finish. We were across the other side, which I thought was actually better. It was also cheaper. but it actually turned out to be better. And we were sort of keeping an eye on how things were panning out. And the guys come round on their truck at the start, and the noise and the racing was really good, especially between the front two. Max Frick had been in the world final a couple of weeks previously. Chris Bomber-Harris is a household name in British Speedway. It was a really cool night out. And it just finished off our day off lovely, because we'd been in the spa prior to that for the day.
It's kind of a perfect kind of odd transition to going to the spa. So sort of like you say, speedway in the rain, because like you say, it can get a bit muddy, but it's one of those things I think you need to go see in person. It's so visceral,
absolutely.
The sound, the speed, the noise. And it's also too one of the sports that I remember. Like I say, I mean, sort of going back as a kid, it's just so genuinely family friendly and just like a really, really good, enjoyable evening out.
Yeah, we were stood there with the guys who go on a very regular basis. There was hardly anybody there that didn't have Bellevue Aces colours on, of black, red, and a little bit of white. And we stood there and we're watching and we're getting all excited, ready for the first race. And the first race ends. As soon as the first race ends, everybody cracks open the programmes to the centre pages and starts filling out the heats and the points. Because obviously you get 3, 2, 1, and 0. And two riders from each team and then you tot up the overall points, and then the one who scores the most points after 16 heats is the winner. And they're all filling them in. And it's just almost to a man and woman, they were filling their programs in religiously. And they were so friendly, so welcoming. We're chatting away to them because they can't. It must be a similar group of people that stands in the same place for each meeting. They were all very friendly with each other. And then Jen and I turn up with no colours on whatsoever, looking kind of happy and cheerful with ourselves. If any of the guys, certainly in the UK listening, if you have a relatively local speedway track, not sure if Cradley Heath is still going, but certainly at Pool Pirates, Ipswich, Bellevue in Manchester, or even the smaller tracks like Scunthorpe and places like that, just have a wander down, have a ride down, make a night of it, take the kids. It's such a fantastic evening of sport. It really is. 16 heats. It works out about 17 minutes worth of racing. We were only there an hour and a half, I think, an hour and 45 minutes. But it was such good fun, and you'll love it. It's just another motorcycle sport to give a try, really.
Yeah, and I mean, it's sort of getting out, supporting your local team, and supporting the local facility, you know, and everything as well. So I think that's good. But yeah, I always enjoy it as an evening out. So glad to hear you had a good time, and it sounds like you'd be going back.
Ah, oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I don't know when we will. There's a few changes at work that we spoke about earlier on, so I don't know where we're going to stand in the next month or so. So, but yes, bottom line is we would love to go back, and there's no doubt about it. We will as soon as we get the chance.
Well, speaking of coming back to racing, BSB was back from their summer break for round 6 at Snetterton. I was just trying to do the math. I think there's only 3 rounds remaining now before the showdown kicks in. So that's Thruxton, Cadwell and Alton with the triple header. So there's 7 races. And I think I started to realise going into this weekend at Snetterton, in some respects, there was kind of like a race. There was going to be a race within a race. Because when I was having a look at the championship points going in, I think we've got, you know, the top three, Scott Redding, Tommy Bridewell and Josh Brooks in the championship, looking pretty safe there, I think, to make the showdown. So it's starting to look, you know, the race for the sort of, definitely for 6th place, 5th place as well. So it was those people who were just outside, the Christian Iddens, Peter Hickman and Andrew Irwins of this world, who needed to have a really good showing at Snetterton.
I have a theory on that as well.
That you can share now, or you will say
later when we go through the points. Okay. after the round. It's not a particularly earth-shattering theory. It's just me looking at the points
yours,
table.
It's yours, and we will give it the due, you know,
due diligence.
Yeah, exactly. that it deserves. Well done. You came up with the theory.
Thanks, mate. Well, we'll give it half an hour, and then we'll come back to it.
Okay. But yeah, so I think, like I say, for me, you know, sitting down to sort of catch up with the events over Snetterton, especially too, you know, I think we knew Snetterton is a pretty fast track. I think it's one of the longest tracks on the BSB circuit. I mean, the lap times are what, like 148?
It is, since they reverted to the national circuit at Silverstone.
Yeah. So, and I mean, you know, it has quite a flow to it, apart from sort of like one slow hairpin.
It's a fabulous circuit.
We knew the Ducatis were going to be strong there. So, like I say, with the top couple of top spots in the championship looking fairly secure, like I say, I think my focus was starting to be on some of those, not middle runners, but you know what I mean? Like I say, the Christian Iddens, the Peter Hickman, Andrew Owens, Dan Linford. Yeah. And there was definitely some news going in, because we had people like former Moto3 Danny Kent making his BSB debut with the Bike Devil MV Augusta Racing Squad.
Yeah, Dave Tyson's team. He ran an MV Augusta team in British Supersport for a while. Dave's been around the paddock for quite a while. I was chatting with Danny, actually, now you mention his name, when we were at Donington for World Superbikes, hospitality, hobnobbing, as we do.
As you do, of course.
It was the gentlemanly thing of meeting him coming out of the gents. as Toby Moody used to do, as Jack Burnick, I was just coming out of the gents' toilets, and I met Danny Kent on the way in. Had a good chat with Danny there, and he's really pumped for the rest of the season. He is completely aware that there's an awful lot of work to be done. And as we go through what happened over the weekend for the Bike Devil MV Agusta team, that he knows where he's at. He's not going into this blind. He's not going into this making rash decisions. He's fully aware that there are going to be issues on the way. So it was a good little chat with him. It was the first time Jen had met him. He's absolutely down to earth, very grounded. He's put, I think, 5 or 6 kilos on in mass as well that he didn't have on the Moto 3 or the Moto 2. So he's looking bigger and stronger, but still very lean. Because all he's done is train for the last 7 months. He hasn't had a ride. So it was good to catch up with DK, and it was really good to see him back on a bike at Snetterton.
Yeah, I think they were always going to, you know, have a bit of a struggle, because realistically they're having to do their testing and development in the race weekends. But I think, you know, their real plan is to figure out what they need to get done, what they need to get in place, really sort of ready for a proper run in 2020. But it was pretty impressive to see how organized and how professional they were looking, just, you know, even from the short time that they had formed.
Yeah, Dave runs a tight ship. He's no mug. He knows what's going on.
Exactly. I mean, they're running the X World Superbike of Leon Cammia. So, you know, before they even start, there's a whole new electronics package that they need to get set up and installed, and a lot of work just to get that dialed in and connected with the bike.
The one thing that did surprise me is that they did a test at Thruxton prior to the Snetterton weekend, but they ran it on the World Superbike electronics.
Yeah, I don't know how often that bike has been run. So, I have a feeling that was probably just maybe getting Danny, getting some bike time to get used to the bike itself.
Maybe so. It just seemed strange. It just seemed odd to do it. That was all, because it's not what he's going to be riding. It'll change the feel of the bike completely.
Yeah, for sure. I just think they would have lost a lot of valuable track time if they'd started to work on the electronics at that time.
No, true enough. And speaking of track days and things like that, Scott Redding was on the same. When we spoke to Danny on the Saturday, he was going to Snetterton on the Monday to turn a couple of laps on a road bike, which is the same day that Scott Redding was there. And they know each other well. They're from the same neck of the country, and they all used to be. I think it was Scott Redding, Danny Kent, and Danny Webb were the three musketeers of the sort of junior world championship. They were all inseparable nightclubs. They were proper boys going around Europe, that's for sure. So they go back a long way, those two.
You said Scott was doing a track day there?
Yeah, he was.
Just to find his way?
We'll find it every time. He won't turn up. We've said this a couple of times, and there's going to be an awful lot of talk of Scott Redding as we go forward. He's not going to turn up at any track short of possibly Thruxton, because bike time there is so limited. He's not going to turn up anywhere and not know where he's going. Yeah. He's already done Cadwell on his road bike. He did that sometime after, between Donington and Alton, I think. So he's already been there.
You know, you get these fast track day riders who think they're really, really fast, and then a proper racer turns up.
Who's never been there before.
Yeah, I mean, the gap is night and day. I mean, it's just horrifically how fast the racers, when they really are on full attack mode, can come through. So if he kind of went there a little incognito, I think that would have been hilarious.
I mean, you're a seasoned track day man. You're a fast group man. You know your way around a circuit. You know how to ride. When Simon comes past on a hot lap, do you just shake your head and park the bike?
Yeah, I mean, we do some of the track days, and a lot of the, you know, Swedish and other Northern European super stock and super bike teams come down to do testing. So, you know, if you know that, if you see that they're there, and you'll know because all the trucks are all lined up in the garages, yeah. You know, you normally book the event in the fast group. The first thing you do is to go to the organizer and say, actually, can you bump me down a group? Because they will slice you and they will dice you. I mean, any which way, none of this like nice track day etiquette of a kind of a meter and a half. I mean, every second of track time for them is valuable. And, you know, it's very, very expensive. They put a lot of mileage to come in and test. And, you know, you just become like mobile chicanes, and they can go around, you know, tracks. It may not sound a lot, like, you know, 5, 6, 8 seconds quicker than you. But when you see that speed difference on the track, I mean, it's just, it's another level.
There's a video on that's been doing the rounds on Facebook for a couple of years now, and YouTube and various places. And it's a guy coming down the start finish straight at Cadwell Park. He's in the fast group, and he said, I feel like a track day god. And he said, but I've just been made to feel like a little baby on a push bike.
Yeah.
It's because the video shows he's coming down to turn one at Coppice, and he's braking, and he looks kind of quick. His speedo says he's kind of quick, but all of a sudden Josh Brooks comes barreling down the outside of him on a McCam Yamaha, and it's like he stood still. It's like, why are you braking there? Brake up there. And it's just the
it's
difference.
A different level. Completely different level. That's why, like I say, it's always entertaining. You know, if you can get some track time with them, especially to see other people's faces. So that would have been great. I just want to move on. Who else was there? Hector Barbera.
He was there
as well.
He was in for Glenn Irwin. Glenn developed a virus in his left eye, which meant his vision was quite closed. I think he only had like half vision or very clouded vision in his left eye. So unfortunately, Glenn had to sit out of the weekend, and Hector Barbera was brought in to the JG Speedfit Kawasaki team to deputise really well. And to be honest with you, I can see him doing a full-time ride next season, you know. I don't know who with, maybe with JG Speedfit, with a Kawasaki team, or with another team, but I really can see Hector Barbera being there full-time next season.
Well, I think Jack Valentine, I saw an interview saying he's really appreciated having him spend some time on the bike. He says, with his knowledge and experience, the feedback that they've got from him has been really, really precious to help them develop that, because they're still, definitely having difficulties with that new Kawasaki, fine-tuning it to get the performance, especially the type of performance they were seeing last year.
They are, and having a rookie and a guy in the team who's only ever ridden a Ducati twin superbike, he doesn't know, he has nothing to compare it to. So it has been difficult for Glenn to do what he needs to do, and frustrating for all concerned. So having Hector Barbera in the team, if he's changed things on the bike and he's made things a little more usable, hopefully if Glenn's back at Cadwell Park, he'll notice the difference, and it will push him into the, ideally the top 12 on a regular basis, if not the top 10.
Well, as we know, 24 hours is a long time in motorcycle racing, and the day after recording this episode, it was announced, in fact, that Glenn Irwin and the Quattro Kawasaki British Superbike team have, in fact, parted ways. It's expected that Hector Barbera will remain with the team for the upcoming Thruxton round, but no news yet as to where Glenn might land, although there are a few possibilities for this year and some rumours floating around already, but nothing concrete as yet. And we also had Michael Laverty back standing in for Keith Farmer at Tyco BMW.
Yeah, good to see him back. He was the only choice, really. There isn't really anybody else about, and the weekend didn't clash with his BT Sport or his World Superbike commitment. So he was the number one shout for that ride, and it gives the team a little bit of feedback. It was the first time he'd ridden the brand new S1000RR in place of Keith Farmer, who continues his rehabilitation from his two broken legs from Knock Hill. He's been on a pedal bike this week. The dressings are starting to come off. He's starting to move around, get a little bit more mobile, and get himself back on track as soon as possible, really. But he's doing well. But it was good to see M. Love back. It was nice to see an old face in there. And he didn't really disgrace himself either.
No, I thought he rode really, really well. And at the end of the day, he brought it home for finishers.
Absolutely, yeah. He didn't bend it, and he brought it home, blew the flies off the front, and gave it back to them.
And I guess it was no surprise to see Christian Iden back after his crash at Knock Hill. I mean, anybody else, I think they would still be laid up at home. But we know Christian isn't bothered by little things like pain.
Nah, pain's just an inconvenience to him, isn't it? He just doesn't bother. He's an incredible man. I don't know whether it comes from his supermoto days for some reason, but he has a really high pain threshold. And he's either that or he's just daft enough for it not to bother him.
Yeah, well, we remember last year with the collarbone.
Yeah. Yeah, the big hole in his arm at Knock Hill the year before. You know, there hasn't been, and this confirms it from Knock Hill as well, I can't remember the last full season Christian Iden did without getting some sort of serious injury.
And as we said earlier in the show, he's one of those people sat there in seventh coming into this. So, he knows he needs to ride and he needs to get those points if he wants to get himself into the showdown. And I think he also knew too that there is a like another week or two, I guess. When's Thruxton's, what,
week
beginning
on,
of August?
Yeah, week. It's a week on Friday, first practice.
Yeah, so I guess he's got like another 2 weeks to mend up a little bit more before getting back on the bike at Thruxton. And another man back from injury as well was Ryan Vickers with on the RAF regular and reserves Kawasaki. He was back from injury riding this weekend.
At his and his team's own, home circuit. Ryan Vickers, just from the other end of the A11, so the 10 miles away from the circuit, down the dual carriageway, first roundabout you come to, heading away from the circuit and from Norwich in general. You come to Thetford, Ryan Vickers' hometown. And the team based at Swaffham, a handful of miles in the sort of a northeasterly direction from the circuit. So they couldn't be more local if they tried, really.
Yeah, so it was good to see him back, and good to see him back on the bike, and good for the team as well to see them running again.
Yeah, a full lineup of 30 riders, it makes World Superbike look a bit dropped off, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But however, you know, 30 riders, all of varying degrees of fitness and health and form. Form is a big word. Looking at qualifying. When you look at, you know, James Ellison missing out, you know, dipping out after Q1, Jason O'Halloran. I mean, did you see that?
I didn't catch the qualifying, but the one thing I did hear before the qualifying kicked off was Peter Hickman confirmed that they are still running a stock engine.
Indeed, they are
in that bike,
which should be quite a bit of a worry for the rest of the teams. I know it's not going to make it into a missile akin to the Ducati, but it's not going to be far behind. If he can perform that well on a bike that's still on essentially a stock engine, when they get
this track,
at this track as well, the BMW have never won at, I hasten to add.
He was top finishing BMW, I think, in the qualifying.
Michael Abtey was 13th, but Hickey crashed in Q3. That was an unfortunate thing for him.
Yeah, it was funny. He was kind of, you know, I think he was a bit laughing on the grid, saying that was a bit of a rookie schoolboy mistake. Ran slightly wide out on the corners.
He just dropped off the edge of the curve, yeah, and it threw him over the top. Which is, Jason Halloran did that on the Sunday as well, but a different part of the circuit, I believe. But Jace had a nightmare in qualifying. Coming towards the end of Q1, he crashed going into Agostini's. He lost the front going into Agostini's. Which is turn 4, before they come back away from the grandstand. Crashed there, managed to get the bike back, the crew managed to get the bike fixed, got him back out for one flying lap, managed to get over the line before the checkered flag came out, came into turn 4 again, and crashed again at exactly the same spot. But this time it looked like the rear had locked up. And now I know somebody had been saying they've been playing with the engine braking strategies and trying to improve things for him. And I think it possibly caught him out with the engine braking, because it's certainly that the rear did lock.
Yeah, the engine braking though shouldn't lock up the rear like that. I mean, because you've also got a slipper clutch typically in there as well. So I mean, normally you know there's some you can change like spring pressure or something in the slipper clutch as well, you know, to control how much kind of retardation, I guess, you
it is. I don't know whether it was electronic engine braking or whether it was mechanical. It definitely snapped on the way in, definitely. Yeah. And he, as is the phrase, trudged off angrily. Which left him down, marooned in 21st place.
Again, it was another weekend to sort of contrast Jason's fortunes with that of his teammate.
Very mixed fortune, very different to how Taz is doing. Taz is almost the model of consistency.
Well, and he's seemingly the only other bike and rider, really, who could sort of bring it to the Ducatis this weekend.
Oh, certainly on that front, yeah. But his race finishes and his crashes that he had at Brands has cost him. The crash at Knock Hill cost him. And if you can hear bikes in the background, it's bike night around here. It's Wednesday, and I'm sat here with my back doors wide open.
And for people listening in America, yes, that is an English euphemism.
It's exactly that. Yeah. Sorry for the American listeners who sometimes my sense of humor is lost on them. I'm aware of that, and I apologize profusely.
Let's just say you do not want to be caught out in public with your back doors wide open.
Absolutely not. it's frowned upon, and they certainly will be carrying you away in a strange jacket, accompanied by two of Her Majesty's finest. The qualifying, it had rained, I think, earlier on in the day, but it was dry for qualifying, so that was good. It had given some really serious sort of downpours, as comes over here with our heat and our summer. We often get thunderstorms, the same as I'm sure you do over there, with the difference in temperatures and the variations. But yeah, when you go through missing out in Q1, James Ellison's Seasons of Woe continues. Ryan Vickers is still coming back in form from his crash at Brands Hatch. And then Jason have to his issues. After that, it was the usual suspects. Danny Kent wasn't the very last bike to go through. That was, unfortunately, Dean Hipwell by a good 0.2 of a second. But good to see a friend of the show, Joe Francis. He made his way into Q2 quite comfortably on the new 2019 S1000RR. As you remember in the interview, he said he was still running the 2018 bike, which they did up until Knock Hill. Now he has the 2019 bike, so he can work on that. He was just behind Josh Elliott, an injured Christian Idden, and the newly arriving at Snetterton, Hector Barbera. He'd never seen the place before. It was new to him.
Yeah, I think in qualifying, he was just feeling his way around.
Absolutely.
So to speak, yeah.
Absolutely. Michael Laverty, Luke Mossy, Luke Stouford and Brad Ray, the three Suzukis all together. So the Suzukis are starting to build, to start to come back, but they're still just that little bit off the pace in qualifying. Always a little bit different for qualifying. You know, they're running the bare minimum fuel loads, whether they've kept the right tyre, whether they've done what they need to do.
I don't know if Bradley Ray, you know, just took a little bit of confidence away from that being the fastest Suzuki.
Yeah, you'd like to think so. You'd like to think so, especially after his dismal appearance there last year when he DNF'd twice at both at turn four and in the first race taking out Glenn Irwin with him. So it wasn't a happy hunting ground for Brad Ray last year. So this year he was looking to make amends for certain. Q1, as we said, Peter Hickman unfortunately had managed to launch himself into almost into orbit, coming out of Richie's the final turn. He just got on the power. He's just trying to make a run for it. He went over the curb. And because the curbs drop off, they're not a linear finish. There's a raise and then there's a drop off. Unfortunately, as it dropped off, the rear wheel spun up and spat him off, which brought out the red flags, unfortunately, which kind of miffed Taran McKenzie and Scott Redding because they were both on really good laps. And I believe Scott Redding was on course for a lap record on a low, he was looking, I think he was aiming for a high 46, something like that. The lap record was, what was that? Was that a 148.141, something like that? Scott wasn't far off Shakey's record anyway. It was somewhere around there. I forget what the lap record is. But making it through into Q3 were Hickman, Irwin, Buchan, Forres, Linfoot, Brooks, Bridewell, McKenzie, and Redding. In that reverse order, really.
And the two Hondas, for me, I think when I look at that, that slightly surprising. I don't know why.
No.
I know if I still haven't quite adjusted, because it does, I'm starting to see, I think Honda are definitely on an extra level of performance this year than they have previous years. Would that be fair?
No. May I debunk that slightly?
Bunk away.
at the faster and flowing circuits, Silverstone, Donington Park, Snetterton, I would expect Assen, potentially Brands Hatch, but certainly Donington Park International as we go there again later on. Yes. They are coming. Andrew Ewing is certainly coming to the fore. He had his best result at Knock Hill, and then we'll go on to his results here later. But Honda traditionally always go well at Snetterton. Jason O'Halloran won one race for Honda, and Dan Linfoot could have won the other one, but for a big scare on the coming out of Richie's on the final lap in sight of the flag. So Snetterton is a big Honda track without a shadow of a doubt. But yes, they are making good progress and they are hitting some consistency. and Andy Irwin is proving to be quite the revelation this year. Shane Byrne said it in commentary again. He said the two Irwins in the British Superbike Championship, one talks, one listens.
And Andrew is definitely one of those people who I was going to be watching this weekend, because sat there in ninth. I think he definitely needs a few consistent finishes to give himself a chance of sneaking into that top six.
Yeah, he does. And that's what we're going to come to towards the end of it when we look at the championship table. There aren't as many names as last year, I don't think, that will be challenging for that sixth place. I think we had sort of seven or eight names at this point last year that had a reasonable chance of getting where they are. I think there's a bit more consistency amongst the front guys. I mean, look at Dan Linfort, fifth place for Dan Linfort, and then we'll see what happened to him in the races. He did the same at Knockhill. He's qualifying so well this year. His one lap pace is absolutely incredible for the Tag Yamaha.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because I mean, you know, in some respects, Taran is demonstrating what the Yamaha is capable of as a package.
Oh, sure.
So in some respects, to see sort of Dan up there, as well as we know he's got the talent, we know he's a fast rider, and, you know, clearly I think the Yamaha can be a fast bike. So in some respects, it wasn't a surprise. It was just a delight.
You know, oh, yeah. It's all that, but he's just not putting it into race pace for whatever reason. The bike isn't set for 16 laps.
And then I think, yeah, the top three, two were probably no big surprise. Okay, Josh Brooks in fourth, Tommy Bridewell in third, Taran McKenzie in second, and Scott Redding, first time out at Snetterton, takes pole position.
Yeah, he took the clean sweep, FP1, FP2, FP3, and qualifying. So he was saying it's like a scaled down MotoGP track. You can see the next corner. It's quite a flat circuit. You can gauge where you need to be and you can do what you have to do. And it was really interesting watching him. And this is something that I've noticed over the last few rounds. Scott Redding does not toe the party line on a racing line. He finds his own way round a circuit. And there's many a time it looked like he'd run deep into turn two at the hairpin, yet he hadn't, because he just picks it up and fires it out. And it was the same coming out of turn six and seven. You know, he finds his own niche with regards to where he wants that bike, how he wants it to react when he cracks the throttle, and to be able to stand it up earlier. And he's visibly quicker and on the brakes as well. At a track he's never been to, he made Josh Brooks kind of look ordinary in the closing stages of race one. So yeah, he's the kid is an absolute superstar, and for BSB he's an absolute breath of fresh air. When you look at him coming in and how he was on the Monster Energy Riot rig, he was crowd surfing, he was throwing things in. The kid is having the time of his life. He's been on the GP circus for so long, but now he's come to BSB. The fans love him. The fans can get to him, whereas at MotoGP they can't unless they have paddock passes. And it's quite, as you know, it's quite a sterile environment. But at BSB, where the fans can get to him, he can interact with his fans. He's winning races. He's leading challenges. He's leading charges. And he's having an absolute ball. And when you look at Scott and you look at him against the rest of the grid, they look boring. He's really thrown a bit of a social hand grenade into BSB. He has more personality in himself than almost the rest of the grid put together. It sounds harsh, but it's not meant to be. It's an observation of mine. It's my opinion, so it counts for nothing, I know. But it's how I perceive it. And you then look at other riders in the championship and you're like, okay, no. Could you imagine him doing that? God, no. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They almost all come out with the same thing. They almost all come out with the same party line. They almost all come out with the same quotes sometimes. They all speak almost exactly the same.
Yeah, I think though, like, so going back to MotoGP, I spoke to Scott a few times in the MotoGP paddock, and he was, you know, by and large, having a really hard time.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't get to see a lot of how you see him now I mean, he was pissed off, fucked off. I mean, upset. You know, he put, really, you could see a lot, the effort that went into his racing for not a lot of payback.
Oh, for the MotoGP section, yeah, certainly.
With a ton of frustration. So, you know, most of the time when you caught him, if you spoke to him, you didn't see that because he was having a bit of a shit weekend, to be honest. So you didn't see that. I think we always knew that that personality was there, that side of him was there. You know, it would kind of come out maybe off season or in through some of the social media, which he certainly made his own.
Very much.
I think in that last 1 or 2 years of MotoGP, when it's just like, oh, you know, there's nothing I can do to cock it up. You know, I'm unlikely to go anywhere else in this team. There's no reason to sort of like toe a media party line.
Sure.
And I think, you know, he'd tend to just kind of like let it go, thinking like, yeah, you know, I've got nothing to lose here. I think I would say that when he came to BSB initially, I think he was a little bit quiet and kept a lid on it. And just until he started to find his place. But now I think he's found his place. He's found his confidence. He's kind of gelled with the bike. He's, you know, he's cracked some of the tracks that a lot of the naysayers said that he wouldn't do.
Yeah.
I'm seeing someone now who's just sort of growing in confidence, and it's really starting to all kind of like be let out and come out.
And that's ominous for the rest of the grid.
Yeah, it is. That, I mean, that sort of that confidence, it just, I mean, you can't buy that. You really can't. It just, and it's just infective. And it's not just for him, it's for the whole team, for his crew and everything as well. And, you know, it's like you say, try and imagine some of the other riders adopt that kind of mindset. You know, you just can't, you couldn't see it. So it is great. I mean, it's great for the fans. It was great to see him, especially, like you say, for the paddock show. Just transform it.
I was trying to avoid the word boring, but it's a figure of speech more than anything.
You know, it's that sort of predictable.
Their demeanor.
You know what it's like. You kind of do these things kind of once or twice, and they just start to become a bit formulaic.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have someone just sort of, like you say, kind of shake it up a little bit.
And it might shake them up as well to show the reaction of the fans and just to make things just be a bit of a slightly different character. It's pretty cool to see it. But, he banged it on pole.
It's the results that count, though, at the end of the day, I think. So, you know, he can talk the talk because he can walk the walk, so to speak.
And that's the most important thing.
Yeah. So what did you think of race one itself?
Do you know what? I actually... That sounded like Shane Byrne then. Do you know what? I actually didn't think the racing was particularly great.
Yeah, it was a bit boring, wasn't it?
Thank you. Good, I'm glad you backed me up on that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was basically... You know, McKenzie tears off into the lead with the Ducatis chasing him down very quickly. You know, the four of them have got a gap over the rest of them. And then it was a bit of a shame too, because like for me, there was a bit of a race going on, but it was more for that sort of mid-pack position. You know, it's the kind of Laverty, Iden, O'Halloran, battling a bit, kind of Andy Irwin fighting Forrest in fifth and sixth. And the director was having a bit of a hard time, at least the coverage I was watching, trying to show this, where it's kind of where the good stuff was, but trying to keep a track, on the leaders.
Yeah, because the gap wasn't that... The gap between the front three wasn't quite big enough between them to leave it for too long.
Yeah.
And especially once, unfortunately, Tommy Bridwell exited stage left on lap five, that kind of shook things up a little bit. That was super disappointing for him.
Well, it was, because I got the sense too, is like, you know, I think we've been looking at his results and he's been feeling that the next step, that the thing that he needs to do is win a race.
It is. And unconditionally.
I think he really fancied his chances here. And I think that's why, you know, he pushed hard to get to the front early on. And I think he was pushing a bit too hard to try and build a gap, understandably. And I heard that when he went down to Agostini's, he went in about 10 kilometers faster than the normal. And he couldn't get the bike, you know, stopped and turned. And the front went, and that was it.
Which is something I don't want to be harsh on the guy. Let's just be objective. It's nothing he hasn't done before.
Well, this is the first season where he started to put consistency together.
And the first time he leads a race, he bins it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, he was obviously mad at himself for that. You knew that was going to be the case as well, because I think Well, we'll see for the other races during the season, but I think he was right. In some respects, I think this was probably his best chance for his highest finish, but I think Reading was always going to take the win.
I think potentially so, but it would have been nice to see them dice together and just see exactly what would have unfolded. There was a sub-story to Tommy's weekend in that Saturday was the 12th anniversary of the passing of his brother, Ollie.
In a
crash in the rain at Mallory Park, and that really played on his mind all weekend. Tommy's in a very, very emotional character, and sometimes that does bleed over into his racing.
But equally too, wasn't, like, this time last year, wasn't this when he was sacked from Halsall Racing?
It was at this round. I don't know if it was at this time of year, but it was certainly at the Snetterton round. He parted company with Halsall Racing. Kyle Ride parted company with Craig Fitzpatrick. There were two or three people that parted company at Snetterton because it was the opposite way round. Snetterton came after the road racing break and then they went to Knock Hill because it was after that that, if I remember right, that Taylor McKenzie was let go.
Right, from Wilf Moore's
team. And that's when the marriage with Tommy Bridewell started.
So in some respects, I would hope if he kind of looks back of where he was to where he is.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think that's pretty impressive.
What a difference a year makes.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's worth bearing.
No, I agree. Guys that didn't quite make it to the checkered flag, Danny Kent was meatball flagged on lap 5. They've had issues with the oil coming through at the clutch, I believe. Ryan Vickers crashed at the chicane. James Ellison pulled in. Tommy Bridewell, as we said, he crashed, unfortunately, on lap 8. Luke Stapleford crashed. Sam Coventry didn't finish. And unfortunately, Josh Elliott, he pulled in due to serious chassis problems. He'd already run on a couple of times and then decided that discretion was the better part of valour.
I don't know if he got an opportunity to try and put in a fast lap as possible.
He wasn't fast
enough. But I think he only got, 10 laps in?
Yeah, it wasn't the quicker. He was a good 0.9 slower than he was in qualifying. So it from whatever happened in the race, it just didn't work out for him. It was potentially a dud tyre. So he was hoping to make amends for that in race 2. But as you said, Scott Redding took the win from Josh Brooks, Taran McKenzie. Taran made a bit of a fight back, but unfortunately, he lost grip towards the end of the race, which sort of he lost the coattails of Josh Brooks. Danny Buck in a fine fourth place. Andy Irwin, a good performance in fifth, matching his best at Knock Hill, with his teammate just behind him. That was quite a cool little battle, swapping a little bit of paint between them, but Andy getting the upper hand.
Yeah, and I think that was an important win for him, just to finish ahead of his teammate.
Oh, without a doubt.
And then, we had Peter Hickman as well. I had Luke Mossy, Jason O'Halloran, and Christian Iden in 10th.
Good recovery for Jason to get 9th place from 21st on the grid. So 16 solid laps under his belt. Christian Iden with a makeshift splint on his leg, on his broken tibia.
I think he was saying like the pain wasn't the bigger problem. It was more the mobility in his ankle was causing him the problems.
That makes sense. Because I think with the broken leg, once it's held in place, the pain isn't too much. It's more the mobility and getting around the bike. But he managed to put one over on MLAV anyway. He managed to pass MLAV. They had a bit of banter on Twitter this week, which was quite good. Joe Francis just missing out on a point of his first point of the season. Claudio Corti taking that last place. Dan Linfoot, 14th place.
Yeah, this is back to your point too, you know, having the single lap pace in the qualifying, but consistently run those times.
And that has to be a setup. That's not a Dan thing. That for me, that's a setup thing to be able to deal with the bike as it goes off. I know they've had brake issues with the Santander Tag Yamaha R1. So it's interesting to see how he'll cope with that for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because if you look at Dan's fastest lap, a 1:49.1, I mean, it's not particularly quick. You know, when Scott's doing, and Scott and Josh are doing 1:47.8.
Even if he got an early 1:40, if he got a 1:48.1, 1:48.2.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a way off. But you could see from free practice and qualifying that it was going to be a stretched out race it wasn't going to be a knock hill where it was all covered by, you know, a tenth of this, a tenth of that. It was somebody just having their Indian delivered, if you heard the strange Fiat Punto noise. go past the doors. I live next to the entrance.
A couple of onion bargees.
Yeah, basically, that's pretty much what he's bringing, yeah. That's pretty much it.
The one thing I did notice is with Scott Redding taking the win, he seems to be falling into a bit of a pattern now of, you know, trying to get away good, get away clean,
yeah,
but not push too hard in the opening laps. You know, just sort of like find a good marker, whether it's Josh or Taron, you know, someone the front runners there, and just sort of settle in. You know, he seems to just let the tires get up to temperature. He likes, you know, sort of watch people, see what they're doing. You know, he's happy to follow close enough, and start to figure out, you know, where he's got the margin on him. And I think we definitely saw Scott did have something in hand on Josh. There was a few times I thought Scott was running it wide, but I think that was more because he was carrying more speed into some of the corners and Josh was a little bit in his way, but he'd always get it back in the exit and was right there. And then, you know, when the time comes, he was just able to nice clean under the brakes, I think, at the end of the straight there, slip up past Josh, and then last couple of laps, you know, he just sort of like turns it on, doesn't he?
Absolutely. He admitted he took it steady in the early part of race one because he'd had a bit of an off in morning warm-up, which was that his first crash of the season, apart from being taken out by Andy Irwin in race one. Race one at Silverstone. His consistency is unerring. His racecraft. I will always wax lyrical about Scott Redding in BSB. I think he's a fantastic addition. I think it's fascinating to watch how he works over the weekend. The Eurosport team were chatting to Giovanni Crupie, his crew chief, ex-crew chief Shane Byrne, when he was at the PBM team. And he said, literally, after four or five laps, he'd got his head around the circuit. I know he'd done it on a road bike, so yes, he knew which way it went, and yes, he knew what he had to do. But to actually be dialed in and be leading the times after four laps is pretty fucking special.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, his race effort, his work ethic is second to none, and that's something that's surprising a lot of people. Because he goofs around on social media, because he gives it large on there, you know, he's a very, very talented racer. He's a very, very clever racer as well. And I have no doubt that it's going to turn into the Scott Redding show between now and the end of the season. And it's up to Taz McKenzie, Tommy Bridwell, Josh Brooks to stem that tide.
Well, obviously, Josh is on the same machinery. And I, you know, I sometimes wonder, how does Josh feel when he's, you know, when he sees that? I mean, you know, look at the best lap for that race one, 147.805 for Scott Redding. Josh Brooks, 147.872, so, you know, 0.07 of a second slower. I mean,
yeah, they've been almost inseparable on times.
Anybody would think, like, you know look at that, so, equivalent machinery, ex-MotoGP racer, you know, look how I compare. But I don't think Josh is thinking that. I think Josh is like, what do I need to do to beat this guy?
Absolutely. And it's making him raise his game as well. And it's also making Taz McKenzie raise his game.
Those are the three, along with Tommy Bridwell. I think they were really the only sort of people in with a shout of a win this weekend.
Yeah, they were. The only saving grace for Tommy Bridwell was that he posted the fastest lap. A 147.6, which put him in pole position for race two, ahead of Scott Redding and Josh Brooks. So an all Ducati lockout on the front row, with Taron McKenzie, a consistent Danny Buchan, and Andy Irwin on row two. Chavi Forest, Christian, and Jason O'Halloran having a much better start from the outside of the third row. So better all round qualifying for the McCam Yamaha boys. The Taz McKenzie is as consistent as ever. But going into race two, there was a little bit of consternation on the sighting lap. Danny Buchan went down at Agostini's. Josh Elliott went down at Nelson's, which is the exit of the chicane at the end of the Bentley Straight. Both of them, you know, have spoken to Josh's dad, and he wasn't on the brakes. He wasn't doing anything he shouldn't have done. There was fluid down on the circuit, which the marshals did, as you could see in Danny Buchan's incident. They were putting the cement dust down and what have you. And according to someone who was there, there was a bike in Parc Fermé with a drip tray under it.
Yeah, it was the GP2 bike of Joel.
Was it Joel Borboom's?
Exactly, from the Supersport race.
Ah.
Came into pit lane, yeah, and they had a catch tray underneath it. And unfortunately, I think the marshals just didn't catch it. I don't know if it was late in the race or on their cool down lap.
Maybe it could have been, yeah, it could have been after the race.
And it was slightly offline from what I understand too, as well. I think a few other people didn't get caught on it because it was on the sort of Supersport GP2 line, the 600 line.
Yeah.
And not on the racing line of the thousands. But unfortunately, I think Danny and Josh were just, you know, on the...
were just unlucky. But I think Josh Brooks has said he could smell something in the air.
Yeah, a few of them said that too. Yeah.
Something had gone on, but I think it was just unlucky for those two.
They're really
unlucky. They were caught out when they were.
Yeah, I'm glad that neither of them were injured, because that would have been a silly, you know, crash to have and then get injured. But unfortunately, neither of them could get out for race two.
Which gave them a head start to get to the plane to go to Japan. We'll come to that.
We'll come to that.
In a bit.
Okay, so, but I guess the big discussion, maybe, I don't know, maybe it is a discussion, I don't know, for race two, was the enormous jump start and the huge advantage gained by Scott Redding.
Are you winding me up?
Yes.
I thought so. The constant, the gnashing of teeth and the amount of wasted characters on social media about this.
Oh, and thank God we had social media, because how else?
Well, yeah, who else would be able to vent their opinion on something that was decided there and then?
I'd have to write this on headed note paper and send it to all my friends.
Dear sir, your reference, our reference. Please note. Please note my displeasure at the non-jump start of Scott Redding.
It has come to our attention. Actually, you know what? I sometimes think that, you know, like things like Twitter and social media should be that. I think people would sit down, fuck it, who cares? And then
absolutely,
yeah, bother,
there has to be a set
it's
format
so easy
for,
now,
for a complaint or an opinion. There's a template there. No opinion or complaint will be filed without the correct template filled in, with all the correct fields completed.
So I don't know about you, but initially, like when the lights went out, I thought there was a bit of a jump start. And so definitely I thought, okay, well, maybe something's going on. But then we got the replay, and as far as I saw, you know, he came to a complete stop.
He did.
There was a bit of a pause. The lights went off, and off he went.
No case to answer.
Well, and the other thing too is BSB rules are slightly different to that of MotoGP that maybe people are used to. But essentially, at the end of the day, race direction, they are the sole judge.
Absolutely. Stuart Higgs is the sole judge of what goes on. And I don't think I don't even know if he uses his team for that, the race direction team. Ultimately, the opinion is of Stewart's. Go back to Cadwell Park last year. Leon Haslam on pole drops the clutch or catches the clutch bites too early, sends him over the line of the grid line as the red lights are on, has to paddle back all 4 foot two of him on tiptoe to then stop, restart and go. Scott didn't move over his grid slot. Yes, he moved forward by about 4 inches, 5 inches maybe, but he did come to a dead stop. So no advantage was gained. He hadn't even got rid of any inertia. You know, he wasn't even rolling.
Yeah.
He'd stopped. It's not an issue. James Whittam on the TV, Whit was... he was picking a fight with all and sundry about it. He was convinced it was a jump start. But I'm in full agreement with Shakey, with Stuart Higgs. It was within the rules. So that there isn't a case to answer. Ethically or morally, that's up to somebody else. But dear outraged of Stourbridge, suck it up. It's the rules and the rules stay. Even Scott Redding wasn't sure if he was going to get a ride through for it.
Yeah.
And the commentators,
I think the team reassured him by ultimately putting OK,
okay
on his
pit board. That's right.
Yeah. To settle him down.
It's not even a debate. It's like the Cal Crutchlow one at Argentina earlier in the year. Rules is rules. You can debate it all night long, but it's black and white.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
exactly.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into that. I'm quite happy, and you'd know it. I'd tell you if I thought there was an injustice. I'm not backwards at coming forwards. That little Fiat Punto's disappearing again. Hopefully, he doesn't back into my car. So yeah, he'd rolled, he'd stopped, it's not a problem, and nobody put a complaint in. He didn't get an advantage, and I don't think he even got the whole shot into turn one, did he?
No, that's right. And then I think even Josh later, after the event as well, said he had no issue with it as well. So I think it's all sort of non-issue. So, but it was the three Dukes basically off into the front with Taz bringing up fourth place. And he was kind of just basically bridging the gap between the following pack. And, you know, by the end of the first lap, those three with Taz slightly just in touch. I mean, they'd already pulled like a good second and a half gap. So again, it became those sort of two races. It became, you know, who's going to be the best of the Dukes at the front. But for me, I was trying to follow that sort of fifth to eighth place race, which was Andy Irwin, O'Halloran again, Christian Iden, and Pete Hickman. And I think that for me, that's kind of really where the action was.
Well, you take the front four out of it and it would have been quite a close podium, really.
Well, until O'Halloran crashed in fifth place.
And that was a big one as well.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually see the crash.
That's fast.
When you see him on his hands and knees, like slowly, heavily crawling away on the grass like that, I mean, it looked like a really heavy high side, I think. Was it out of Nelson?
Yeah, it was, yeah, coming out of the complex. So he's already cranked over. Whether he'd caught it on the edge of the circuit as well, the same as Hickey did in qualifying, but at a different place. But that just about summed his weekend up.
Cannot understand how this guy cannot get a break.
Oh, it's that phrase we've used so many times about falling in a barrel of tits, isn't it? He's just incredible.
I just imagine, like, when people are living, you know, leaving the you know, the circuit, he's like, oh, can I give you a lift? They're like, no, that's right. That's right. We'll walk. We're good.
No, it's all right, I'll walk. It's fine. It's no problem.
Yeah, poor Blake. And then on top of that, you know, I think he hurt his left hand and I was talking after the fact. It's like, oh, yeah, it's fine. You know, you can see the bone through the skin, but other than that, it's fine.
Yeah, typical motorcycle racer's response. Oh, you can see the bone. It doesn't matter. The mere flesh wound. No issues whatsoever. But again, a fairly almost forgettable race, but better than race one.
Yeah, but I mean, it was kind of Brooks, Bridewell and Redding. I mean, Redding, I think fairly early on, was able to slip past Bridewell into second and just go with Brooks. And then basically it was kind of Brooks out in the front. Redding was right with him. And you were just waiting to see when Redding was going to go for it.
You knew it was coming.
Yeah.
It was just a case of when. And that's the thing. And Scott knows what he's got in reserve. A nod to Taz McKenzie. Obviously, unfortunately, you know, he departed on lap 11, but he is absolutely riding the wheels off that Yamaha to try and stay with these boys. He's the only non-Ducati at the moment that can consistently take it to those three Italian monsters.
And he was starting to close, but it was fractions. I think it was like 1/10 each lap. He was having to work incredibly hard.
But the amount of effort he was putting in to do that.
Yeah, for that single tenth.
Was too much.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, he just basically rode off the edge grip of the tyres. I think, you know, the back went, the front went,
yeah.
The whole bike went down. It was just...
And it was a big shame for him, but, you know, it wasn't through lack of trying. That was the thing. And it's that consistency that's hurting him in the championship charge. Where he maybe could have got a third place and a podium credit, you know, that's what's hurting McKenzie at the minute. He's still only a kid, you know, it's only his second season in British Superbikes. He's still learning, as he said to us at Donington Park. So, you know, I'm not being too hard on the little fella at all, but, you know, he's absolutely, what he is doing, he's not getting the end results that he would maybe necessarily would like, but he's certainly flagging up to other teams like, do you know what? I can do this.
Yeah.
But I'm having to override it because those Ducatis are just that little bit too quick. You know, they're an incredible machine. They've done the right thing. It's a little bit different to the homologation version of Johnny Ray's ZX-10, where they only built 500, I think. They're building 500 Panigale V4Rs. So it's Ducati are doing it and have done it right. The new Yamaha R1 and R1M was launched at Snetterton this weekend after the world launch.
Yeah, that's right.
World Superbikes at Laguna Seca. So that,
do you think any of those will appear on the track this year, or do you think they're basically getting themselves ready for next year?
No, they're getting themselves ready for next year. I don't think they would.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Especially for the BSB perspective, that they're not going to upset the apple cart now.
Yeah.
When they need to do what they do to get the bikes ready for BSB specs. And no, they'll stay as they are. I suspect over the next couple of rounds that the silly season will kick off.
Oh, right. Yeah, we haven't had much of that yet, have we, really?
Stuart Higgs was on BSB Radio on Sunday morning. He was saying that, you know, they spoken to various people. He says it's going to be one of the biggest all-round shake-ups that we've seen for a few years. Sam Lowe's name was mentioned. He mentioned Hector Barbera coming in, hopefully coming in full-time. You know, there's going to be a few new faces, I think, next season. There's one or two guys from championships that maybe won't have a ride. You know, will Eugene Laverty have a ride at world level next year? Will Sam Lowe's have a ride at world level next year? Will they come back to BSB? You know, how competitive can Stuart Higgs make it, and how many household names can he fit into that championship?
Yeah.
It at the expense of who remains to be seen, obviously, and what teams come in and what teams don't. But he said that there are talks across various levels are at quite an advanced stage. So we'll hopefully get the lowdown on silly season from my various contacts over the certainly by Cadwell, I would hope.
But hey, getting back to the race, it was essentially Scott Redding who kept his powder dry for lap 13. I think we knew it was coming, and he did. He got the good drive. He outbraked, went past Josh Brooks, and then maybe a little bit early, but he definitely had some extra pace, and very quickly started put some space between him and Brooks, and was able to hang on and take the win with a healthy gap to Brooks in second and Tommy Bridewell in third.
A good result again, and a PBM 1-2 across the whole weekend. I believe that was race one on the earlier in the Sunday afternoon, I believe, was PBM's 100th win in British Superbikes.
Yeah, that's an impressive record,
isn't it? You've got to be around a lot of years to do that and have some pretty decent riders.
Yeah, and the consistency that you'd need to pull that off too.
Yeah,
Nice to see Tommy Bridewell and the Oxford Racing Products team there within a podium as well. He definitely needed that after crashing out in race one.
Yeah, both for his podium credits and I think for his own sanity more than anything.
Yeah.
Which takes us to the championship table. This championship table now is looking somewhat ominous, let's be fair.
Well, it is when you see Scott 226.
For the part of the regular season, Scott will win the regular season. If you can do such a thing, Scott will win the regular season. Tommy Bridewell is 38 points back. Josh Brooks is only 3 points back of Tommy. So Brooks taking fine advantage of finishing ahead of Tommy in both races this weekend with Tommy's DNF and then finishing ahead of him in race two. Mackenzie in fourth, his lack of consistency, not lack of talent or application, just a lack of consistency because of what he's having to do. He's had four DNFs this season already. Yeah. Compared to three for Josh Brooks and just the one for Tommy Bridewell and two for Scott Redding. First race at Brands Hatch, he finished out of the points when it rained, if you remember, but he didn't crash. After that, Danny Buchner has some fantastic consistency. He will be one of the showdown contenders. I don't have an issue with that. It's Xavi Forres, Peter Hickman, Andy Irwin, Christian Eden, and I think that's it. The gap is too big back to Luke Mossy, and the Suzuki hasn't got the legs to keep going into the top 10 to challenge the likes of Irwin and Hickman and Forres on the form that they are on. No disrespect to OMG Racing. You know how much I enjoy the boys' company there and the respect I have for Luke Mossy. The Suzuki hasn't got the pace at this point in time. The 20-point gap to Christian Eden is too much, and Christian, I think they shared the points pretty much, but Christian beat him by 2 points over the weekend overall anyway.
Well, and I think we've spoken about this before as well. Suzuki don't have like a World Superbike team or a factory doing a development.
No, they don't. They're developing their own bike, and it unfortunately, it's showing.
You know, it's kind of interesting to hear that BMWs with Christian Newton, I assume, and Peter Hickman as well, still running fairly stock standard engines. The hope or the potential is, you know, we've seen, well, Superbike level, Tom Sykes are doing good things with the BMW as well. There may be some parts coming, so they could maybe finish the season a little stronger with a little bit of extra performance. But certainly some of the tracks coming up, you know, top speed and horsepower are not necessarily the things you need for places like Cadwell and Alton.
No, and I think Pete will go well at Cadwell on that BMW.
Yeah,
I really do. I think he will be a threat at Cadwell Park. And I think depending on how it goes on setup, I think he'll be a pretty much a threat at Thruxton as well, because he loves that place. It's very Isle of Man. It's bumpy, it's sliding. He can let the bike run. He can let it do what it wants almost. And I think, you know, he did well last year despite his kidney infection. And I think he will go well again a week on Sunday, as will Josh Brooks. That will be a litmus test for him and for Scott Redding. Brooks, he loves it round there. He's won multiple times around Thruxton. It's a track he favours. And it's also Tommy Bridewell's back garden, metaphorically.
And presumably, too, they're also tracks that you'd imagine Terry Forrest having a little harder time with.
Yeah, and the biggest thing at Thruxton is always is tyre wear. It's such an abrasive circuit that tyre management is crucial. Now, whether that'll help or hinder Taz McKenzie being so light, will the bike spin up more because he doesn't have the weight over the rear? Will that negate what he can gain on the back straight and up Woodham Hill into the club chicane?
Just looking down the overall championship points, just to illustrate how poor James Ellison has been faring this season. He's currently 21st in the championship, 22nd. Is Michael Laverty.
After two races.
competing in two races.
Yeah. James DNFs in both races. Michael Laverty finishes in with a 5-point and 7-point finish, yeah, and immediately sits right behind him in the championship. He's only 6 points behind him. It's just, I don't know, there's personal things going on. There's obviously he's not really confident with the BMW S1000. I don't know particularly what suspension he's running, whether he's running K-Tech or whether he's running the Ohlins. Ideally he runs Ohlins because that's what he's used to, that's what he prefers the most, but there's just something not working at all. He's absolutely lost for whatever reason, and whether he'll find that, whether he's still carrying that injury that he didn't tell anybody about until the close season, whether there's still an issue there or not, or whether it's just purely bike and rider, I don't know. I'll do some digging, maybe at Cadwell, and see what we can find out, or talk to a few people in the interim and just see where his head's at, see what the score is, because he should be in the top 10 on a regular basis without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, that, you know, his knowledge and experience, and I mean, I think the bike's a competitive package.
Hickey's showing that, you know, he should at least be regular top 12 on a, you know, week by week, but it's kind of not happening, so that's disappointing.
One other thing I just wanted to mention before we close out the news from Setterton was to talk about the three riders who were injured in the Superstock 600 race. This is Aaron Clifford, Adam Hartgrove and Charlie Morris. All three of them went down in a crash on the warm-up lap.
Yeah.
On the center straight. And unfortunately, it was Aaron who came off worse. I think he was struck twice by the riders. And I mean, luckily, BSB, I think, has one of the top medical teams, and they were quickly on scene, recognised the nature of his injuries and were put him into an induced coma. He was moved by ambulance to Adam Brooks Hospital, and as far as I know, he's still there. So all of us from Motopod wish him and his family all the very, very best in his recovery and rehab.
Absolutely. Echo those sentiments completely.
So we mentioned it before. We do have up and coming races. I guess we know the World Superbike are on the holidays, and they won't be back until what, September?
Christmas.
Beginning of September.
February.
They have a huge break, don't they? Yeah, we got MotoGP. They're back in action week and a half, probably the same weekend,
beginning of August. Thruxton, yeah.
As Thruxton.
Austria.
But between then and now, between now and then, at some point, 28th of July is Suzuka. And some of those familiar family names, like you say, were basically running out of the back of the garage to catch their private jets.
Maybe not. EasyJet. I'm 100% sure Josh flew economy.
To Suzuka. It was almost kind of hard when you go through the entry list of this year's Suzuka 8-hour. I mean, apart from some of the BSB names, I mean, there are riders from all shapes, walks, and everything. We've got world superbike riders like Alex Lowes and Michael Vandermark. Johnny Ray is there with Leon Haslam and Top Rack in sort of a dream team Kawasaki racing team. We've got MotoGP refugees like Brock Parks, Mike Domiglio, Freddie Foray, a whole host of riders mixed in with some other Japanese and other Asian riders as well. So should be quite the event, I think.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, Danny Buchan's out there. Danny Webb's out there. Gino Rea's out there. Josh Elliott got a late call up to go for the R2CL team, the French Suzuki team, which they'd originally asked Billy McConnell, but Billy's still struggling with injury, with illness, coming back from his burst appendix. And he basically said to them, Josh is your man, which I thought was a lovely touch to his OMG Suzuki teammate.
Yeah, I think Stefan Bradl is...
He's in the official HRC team, well, isn't he? It should be an interesting race. It's going to be fascinating. I'm on nights on Sunday after doing a 72-hour week of days, so I shall catch the last couple of hours. I think it finishes about 11:30, something like that. It's 3:30 UK, so that makes it half 11.
So just actually interest, the Josh Elliott team... the team R2CL, Sun Chlorella.
Yeah, I thought team. That said cholera as well when I first read it.
Yeah,
it's
C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A,
something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's an energy drink.
Wow. Some medieval disease.
I'm just curious, do you know who the third rider is going to be?
He's an Aussie, but his name escapes me.
Okay.
There is a third rider and he's Australian.
Right now, that's blank. And it's like, I can imagine Josh turning up. Josh, there's good news and there's bad news.
Yeah. Well, this is what I thought because I saw the entry list and it's just that and his Japanese teammate. But I've had communique from Jules' dad this morning, forwarded on from Josh, and he's having an amazing time. You know, he's running, I think, 2:11, I think, is his best lap so far. Which isn't bad on his first ever visit to the circuit. He said he and his Japanese teammate like the bike very similar, but the Aussie likes it in completely the opposite direction, so he's kind of outvoted. Okay. But yeah. A really nice touch that I thought was really cool. His Japanese teammate took him up to introduce him to the Yoshimura team, the official Suzuki team.
Mm-hmm.
They all knew who he was. And they were, you won at Silverstone. So they knew who he was because he'd won on a Suzuki at Silverstone, which I thought was really nice.
Here we're able to watch the coverage on Eurosport.
Absolutely.
I don't know, for our American friends, what coverage they will have, but I'm sure the dig around will be around somewhere.
I didn't realise until I was talking to our fine co-host, Derek Cabrera, on email the other day, that they now have live British Superbikes in the States. I forget which broadcast company it is, but yeah, I was chatting to him the other day on the email, and yeah, he watched Knock Hill, and he watched Netterton.
Will I get in trouble to say if it's better racing than Moto America?
No, but you just did.
Okay, well, I don't want to risk it then, so I won't say that.
And you also know what's really cool? Derek and his significant other, Gigi, are coming to Cadwell. Seriously.
Oh, fantastic.
He's on a vacation in Europe, or they are on a vacation in Europe, and they're coming to the UK. And it coincides with Cadwell Park, and he's coming up for they're both coming up for race day and staying in Lincoln.
Can you get a more typical BSB event than Cadwell?
I'm so, in the words of our illustrious co-host, I'm so stoked that they're coming. I'm so chuffed that they're going to make it to Cadwell Park. I can't wait to show them around.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example of BSB, the track, the venue,
the fact that location. It's only about 3 foot wide.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Absolutely blow them away. Not just the mountain, but all bends, turn one.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll get them a coffee and we'll visit various hospitality units as well.
Oh, hopefully if you pull out your little dictaphone too, maybe we can get some reactions and some thoughts and impressions.
Do you know what? I'd already thought of that.
Yeah, I think that'll be something special.
I think that's for the end of the day before they go, or midway through the day, just have a, you know, 5 or 10 minute chat, get their idea, get how they feel about Cadwell Park. Because it'll be great for the rest of the listeners who've never been, and certainly for the guys stateside.
Yeah, exactly.
To be able to do that. And whether we can put it on the BSB podcast, but we could also stick it on the end of maybe the MotoGP one as well. For the guys who listen to the MotoGP podcast that maybe don't listen to BSB, it'd be great to hear Derek's thoughts on Cadwell through there as well. So we'll introduce him to a few of the guys in the paddock. It's a difficult one to get to the garages because the garages are in the middle. And the middle is... Cadwell is unique in the fact that once you go through the gate into the upper holding area, where there's a few awnings, it's classed as pit lane. So your standard season pass doesn't get you in there. You need a grid pass, a pit lane pass. So it's always a pain in the backside to get to the garage. You can't. It's like Laguna Seca at the bottom of the hill, or like Laguna Seca used to be, with all the awnings. It used to be an awning city, didn't it? So we'll not be able to get him into the superbike garages, I don't think, but we know enough guys in stock and various other series to be able to show him around a few motorcycles and introduce him to a few of the boys.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. If you can get some audio clips.
Without a doubt. Of course we will.
Him, I think
not
be
a problem.
Fantastic.
My dictaphone will be with me. Yeah. So, yeah, we absolutely will.
Well, stay cool for the rest of the week and for the weekend.
With my little flannel.
God, really? I just got that image out of my mind, and there we are. Ugh. Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking some time sitting down with us. Nice to catch up with you.
Always a pleasure. We'll catch up again after Thruxton. Hopefully a bit more exciting on the racing front.
Yeah, so it kind of goes a little bit quiet, for as the holidays kick in. But yeah, Suzuka will keep us going until MotoGP and then Thruxton. And then, long wait for World Superbike.
So we'll be back with you fine listeners in a couple of weeks.
Dave, thanks again for your time. Take care. We'll catch up with you soon.
Look forward to it. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.
Don't forget, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We're on the Facebook at facebook.com/motopod and on Twitter as well @moto_pod.